posted cavalry to back them up and guard their flanks, then sent them forward, following with the rest of the brigade in attack formation at an interval of about 200 yards. The thing was done in strict professional style, according to the book, but the man he was advancing against had never read the book, though he was presently to rewrite it by improvising tactics that would conform to his own notion of what war was all about. "War means fighting," he said, "and fighting means killing." It was Forrest. Breckinridge had assigned him a scratch collection of about 350 Tennessee, Kentucky, Mississippi, and Texas cavalrymen, turning over to him the task of protecting the rear of the retreating column. As he prepared to defend the ridge, outnumbered 5-1 by the advancing Blue Brigade, he saw something that caused him to change his mind and his tactics. For as the skirmishers entered the vine-tangled hollow, picking their way around felled trees and stumbling through the brambles, they lost their neat alignment. In fact, they could hardly have been more disorganized if artillery had opened on them there in the swale. Forrest saw his chance. "Charge!" he shouted, and led his horsemen pounding down the slope. Most of the skirmishers had begun to run before he struck them, but those who stood were knocked sprawling by a blast from shotguns and revolvers. Beyond them, the Federal cavalry had panicked, firing their carbines wildly in the air. When they broke to, Forrest kept on after them, still brandishing his saber and crying, "Charge! Charge!" as he plowed into the solid ranks of the brigade drawn up beyond. The trouble was, he was charging by himself. The others, seeing the steady brigade front, had turned back and were already busy gathering up their 43 prisoners. Forrest was one gray uniform, high above a sea of blue. "Kill him! Kill the goddamn rebel! Knock him off his horse!" It was no easy thing to do. The horse was kicking and plunging, and Forrest was hacking and slashing. But one of the soldiers did his best. Reaching far out, he shoved the muzzle of his rifle into the colonel's side and pulled the trigger. The force of the explosion lifted Forrest clear of the saddle, but he regained his seat and sawed the horse around. As he came out of the mass of dark blue uniforms and furious white faces, clearing a path with his saber, he reached down and grabbed one of the soldiers by the collar, swung him onto the crupper of the horse, and galloped back to safety, using the Federal as a shield against the bullets fired after him. Once he was out of range, he flung the hapless fellow off and rode on up the ridge where his men were waiting in open-mouthed amazement. Sherman was amazed, too, but mostly he was disgusted. As soon as he had gathered up his wounded and buried his dead, he turned back toward Pittsburgh Landing. Snug once more in his tent near Shiloh Chapel, he wrote his report of the affair. It concluded, "The check sustained by us at the fallen timbers delayed our advance. Our troops being fagged out by 3 days' hard fighting, exposure, and privation, I ordered them back to camp, where all now are." The ball now lodged alongside Forrest's spine as he followed the column grinding its way toward Corinth, was the last of many to draw blood in the Battle of Shiloh. Union losses were 1,754 killed, 8,408 wounded, 2,885 captured. Total, 13,047, about 2,000 of them Buell's. Confederate losses were 1,723 killed, 8,012 wounded, 959 missing. Total, 10,694. Of the 100,000 soldiers engaged in this first great bloody conflict of the war, approximately one out of every four who had gone into battle had been killed, wounded, or captured. Casualties were 24%, the same as Waterloo's. Yet Waterloo had settled something, while this one apparently had settled nothing. When it was over, the two armies were back where they started, with other Waterloos ahead. In another sense, however, it had settled a great deal. The American volunteer, whichever side he was on in this war and however green, would fight as fiercely and stand as firmly as the vaunted veterans of Europe. Now that this last had been proved beyond dispute, the leaders on both sides persuaded themselves that they had known it all along, despite the doubts engendered by Manassas and Wilson's Creek, which dwindled now by contrast to comparatively minor engagements. Looking instead at the butcher's bill, the first of many such it seemed, they reacted as always according to their natures. Beauregard, for example, recovered his high spirits in short order. 2 days after the battle, he wired Van Dorn, still marking time in Arkansas, "Hurry your forces as rapidly as possible. I believe we can whip them again." He believed what he told the wounded soldier, "The day of our glory is near," and saw no occasion for retracting the announcement of complete victory sent to Richmond on the night of the first day. In fact, the further he got from the battle in time, the greater it seemed to him as a continuing demonstration of the superiority of Southern arms. Nor did Davis retract the exultant message he sent to Congress in passing the telegram along. He was saddened, however, by other news it contained, namely the loss of Albert Sidney Johnston. "When he fell," Davis wrote long afterward, "I realized that our strongest pillar had been broken." Reactions on the other side were also characteristic. Once more, Halleck saw his worst fears enlarged before his eyes and got aboard a St. Louis steamboat bound for Pittsburgh Landing to take charge of the army himself before Grant destroyed it entirely. "Your army is not now in condition to resist an attack," he wired ahead. "It must be made so without delay." Grant tightened his security regulations as instructed, but he did not seem greatly perturbed by the criticism. Now, as always, he was a good deal more concerned with what he would do to the enemy than he was with what the enemy might try to do to him, and in any case he had grown accustomed by now to such reactions from above. The battle losses were another matter, providing some grim arithmetic for study. Total American casualties in all three of the nation's previous wars, the Revolution, the War of 1812, and the Mexican War, 10,623 plus 6,765 plus 5,885, were 23,273. Shiloh's totaled 23,741, and most of them were Grant's. Perhaps this had something to do with his change of mind as to the fighting qualities of his opponents. At any rate, far from thinking them heartily tired and ready to chuck the war, he later said quite frankly that, from Shiloh on, "I gave up all idea of saving the Union except by complete conquest." 3. While the ironclad gunboats of the Western Navy were pounding out their victories on the Tennessee, the Cumberland, and the mile-wide Mississippi, past Island 10 they now were bearing down on undermanned Fort Pillow, Memphis, unbraced for the shock, was next on the list. The wooden ships of the Blue Water Navy were not idle in the east. Along the coasts of the Atlantic and the Gulf, where the thickened blockade squadrons hugged the remaining harbors and river outlets, the fall and winter amphibious gains had been continued and extended. 3 times the Monitor had declined the Merrimack Virginia's challenge to single combat in Hampton Roads. If the rebel vessel wanted trouble, let her make it by trying to interfere with the Monitor's task of protecting the rest of the fleet off Old Point Comfort. This she could not or would not do, and the Monitor maintained station in shoal water, content with a stalemate, while elsewhere other Federal warships were stepping up the tempo of Confederate disasters. By mid-March, the month-old Roanoke Island victory had been extended to New Bern and other important points around the North Carolina Sounds, including control of the railroad which had carried men and supplies to the armies in Virginia. Simultaneously, down on the Florida coast, Fernandina was seized, followed before the end of the month by the uncontested occupation of Jacksonville and St. Augustine. Charleston and Savannah had been threatened all this time by the Army-Navy buildup at Port Royal. In April, while preparations were underway for a siege of the South Carolina city, an attack was mounted against Fort Pulaski, the stout brick pentagon on Cockspur Island, guarding the mouth of the Savannah River. Heavy guns and mortars knocked it to pieces, breaching the casemates and probing for the powder magazine. After 30-odd hours of bombardment, the white flag went up and the blue-clad artillerists moved in to accept the surrender. Mostly they were New Englanders, and when a Georgian made the inevitable allusion to wooden nutmegs, a Connecticut man, pointing to a 10-inch solid shot that had pierced the wall, told him, "We don't make them of wood any longer." Savannah itself was not taken, and indeed there was no need to take it. Sealed off as it was by the guns of Fort Pulaski, it was no more important now, at least from the naval point of view, than any other inland Confederate city which had lost its principal reason for existence. Wilmington, North Carolina, a much tougher proposition, with stronger and less accessible defenses, was presently the only major Atlantic port not captured or besieged by Union soldiers. Here the sleek, low, ghost-gray blockade runners made their entrances and exits, usually by the dark of the moon, burning smokeless coal and equipped with telescopic funnels and feathered paddles to hide them from the noses, eyes, and ears of their pursuers. Martial and flippant names they had, the Letter B and Letter Rip, the Fox, Leopard, Lynx, and Dream, the Banshee, Secret, Kate and Hattie, the Beauregard, the Stonewall Jackson, the Stag and Lady Davis. The risks were great. 1 out of 10 had been caught the year before. This year the odds were 1 to 8. But the profits were even greater. 2 trips would pay the purchase price. The third and all that followed were pure gravy, as well as a substantial aid to the southern problem of supply. Last fall, one of the slim, speedy vessels had steamed into Savannah with 10,000 Enfield rifles, 1 million cartridges, 2 million percussion caps, 400 barrels of powder, and a quantity of cutlasses, revolvers, and other badly needed materials of war. For all their reduction of the number of ports to be guarded, the blockade squadrons had their hands full. Meanwhile, down along the Gulf, another federal fleet was scoring corresponding successes to maintain the victory tempo set by its Atlantic rivals. At the mouth of the Florida River, whose name it bore, Apalachicola fell in early April, followed in quick succession by the seizure of Pass Christian and Biloxi on the Mississippi coast. These were bloodless conquests, the defenders having left to fight at Shiloh, alongside the main body summoned north from Pensacola, which in turn was taken early the following month. Like Wilmington, Mobile remained, a much tougher proposition, but even before the capture of Pensacola, the Federals had made substantial lodgments on the coast of every southern state, except Texas and Alabama. Satisfying as all these saltwater victories were to the overall command, the fact remained that, unlike the Western Navy on its way down the Mississippi, they had merely nibbled at the rim of the rebellion. Except for simplifying the blockade difficulties, which was much, they had accomplished very little, really, even as diversions. The problem, seen fairly clearly now by everyone, from Secretary Wells down to the youngest powder monkey, was conquest. Divide et impera, pierce and strangle, which had been the occupation of the river gunboats all these months while the blue water ships were pounding at the beaches. It was time for them, too, to try their hand at conquest by division instead of subtraction. If the Mississippi could be descended, perhaps it could be ascended as well, so that when the salt and freshwater sailors met somewhere upstream like Upper and Nether Millstones, having ground any fugitive elements of the enemy fleet between them, the Confederacy and the task of its subjugation would be riven. Much effort and much risk would be involved. The problems were multitudinous, including the fact that the thing would have to be done by wooden ships. But surely it was worth any effort and almost any risk, considering the prize that awaited success at the very start. New Orleans. The Crescent City was not only the largest in the South, it was larger by population than any other four combined. And in the peacetime volume of its export trade as a funnel for the produce of the Mississippi Valley, it ranked among the foremost cities of the world. Its loss would not only depress the South and correspondingly elate the North, it would indicate plainly to Europe, especially France, where so many of its people had connections of blood and commerce, the inability of the rebels to retain what they had claimed by rebellion. In short, its capture would be a feather, indeed a plume, in the cap of any man who could conceive and execute the plan that would prize this chief jewel from the crown of King Cotton. One man already had such a plan, along with an absolute ache for such a feather. Commodore David Porter had made naval history as captain of the Essex in the War of 1812, and his son David Dixon Porter, 48 years old and recently promoted to commander, was determined to have at least an equal share of glory in this one. What was more, in the case of New Orleans, he knew whereof he spoke. 30 trips in and out of the passes during a peacetime hitch in the merchant marine had familiarized him with the terrain, and months of blockade duty off the river's four main mouths had given him a chance to talk with oystermen and pilots about recent developments in the city's defenses. He knew the obstacles, natural and man-made, and he believed he knew how to get around or through them. Nor was he one to wait for fame to find him. In late 61, he turned up in Washington to unfold his plan for the approval of the Navy Secretary. New Orleans itself was 100 miles upriver, but its principal defense against attack from below was a pair of star-shaped masonry works, Forts Jackson and St. Philip, built facing each other on opposite banks of the river, just above a swift-currented bend 3/4 of the way down. Formerly part of the U.S. system of permanent defenses, they had been taken over and strengthened by the Confederates. Fort Jackson on the right bank was the larger, mounting 74 guns. Fort St. Philip, slightly upstream on the east bank, mounted 52. Between them, with a combined garrison of 1,100 men and an armament of 126 guns, they dominated a treacherous stretch where approaching ships would have to slow to make the turn. Originally, there had been doubt that all this strength would be needed, rivermen having assured the defenders that no deep-draft vessel could ever get over the bars that blocked the outlets. However, this had been disproved in early October when the commander of the Gulf Blockade Squadron, finding the task of patrolling the multi-mouthed river well-nigh impossible from outside, sent 3 heavy warships across the southwest bar and stationed them 15 miles above, at the juncture called Head of the Passes, a deep-water anchorage 2 miles long and half as wide, where the river branched to create its lower delta. As long as those sloops and their frowning guns remained there, nothing could get in or out of the passes. New Orleans would languish worse than ever, her trade being limited to what could be sneaked out by the roundabout route through Lake Pontchartrain and past the vigilant Federals on Ship Island, which had been seized the month before. Clearly, this was intolerable, and the city's defenders prepared to correct it at once. They had a makeshift fleet of 4 flat-bottomed towboats mounting 2 guns each, a 7-gun revenue cutter seized from Mexico before the war, under highly improbable charges of piracy, and a Boston-built seagoing tug covered over with boilerplate and equipped with an iron beak and a single 32-pounder trained unmovably dead ahead. Perhaps to offset her ugliness, all that metal caused her to ride so low in the water she rather resembled a floating eggplant, the authorities had given the ram the proud name Manassas. On the dark night of October 11th, moving swiftly with the help of the 4-knot current, she led the way downriver for an attack on the 3 big warships patrolling the head of the passes. Surprise was to be the principal advantage. The 6-boat flotilla moved with muffled engines and no lights. To help offset the armament odds, 16 guns of moderate size or smaller would be opposed by 51, over half of which were 8-inch or larger. Tugs brought along 3 fire rafts, long flatboats loaded with highly combustible pine knots and rosin, which would be ignited and sent careening with the current when the time came. The plan was for the Manassas to make a ram attack in darkness, then fire a rocket as the signal for the fire rafts to be lit and loosed, and the gunboats to come down and join the melee. The Federals had no lookout stationed, only the normal anchor watches, which would have carried in any harbor. The first they knew of an attack was at 3:40 a.m., when a midshipman burst into his captain's cabin, crying, "Captain, there's a steamer alongside of us." On deck, the skipper barely had time to see an indescribable object amid a puff of smoke even darker than the night. As beat to quarters sounded, there was a crash. The Manassas had struck the 1,900-ton flagship Richmond, which now began firing indiscriminate broadsides like bellows of pain, and hoisted 3 light signals in rapid succession. Enemy present, get underway, act at discretion. All 3 of the sloops were firing frantically, though none of them could see anything to aim at. The Manassas was groping blindly, filled with coal smoke. She had struck a barge lashed alongside the Federal flagship. The force of the blow had knocked her engines loose, and a hawser had carried her stacks away, flush with the deck. In time, she got the rocket off, however, and presently 3 distant sparks appeared upriver, growing in size as the rafts flamed higher and drew closer. Aboard the sloops, delay had only served to increase the panic. "Proceed down Southwest Pass, cross the bar," the flagship signaled, and all 3 went with the current, the sluggish Richmond swinging broadside to it, helpless. 1 got over, the next lodged fast on the bar, stern upriver. Then the Richmond struck and stuck, still broadside. The fire rafts had run harmless against the bank, but the Confederate gunboats, which up to now had not engaged, took the grounded sloops under fire with their small-caliber long-range Whitworths. Presently, the Union flag officer, Captain John Pope, called Honest John to distinguish him from the general who would win fame at Island 10, was amazed to see the skipper of the other stranded vessel appear on the flagship's quarterdeck wrapped in a large American flag. He had abandoned ship, bringing his colors with him after laying and lighting a slow fuse to the powder magazine, intending thus to keep her from falling into the hands of the rebels. After a long wait for the explosion, which would bring what an observer called a shower of 1.5-ton guns through the decks and bottom of almost any nearby ship, it finally became evident that the sloop was not going to blow after all. Pope sent the flag-draped captain back to defend her and, if possible, get her afloat, which he subsequently managed to do by heaving most of her guns and ammunition over the side. It later developed that the seaman charged with lighting the fuse had obeyed orders, but then, not being in sympathy with them, had cut off the sputtering end and tossed it overboard. By now it was broad open daylight. The Confederates withdrew upstream, satisfied with their morning's work of clearing the head of the passes, and Pope made a tour of inspection to assess damages. Except for a small hole punched in the flagship when the Manassas struck the coal barge, there were none. Not a man had been hurt, not a hit had been scored. Or so he thought, until next morning, when he found a 6-pound Whitworth solid lodged in his bureau drawer. Explaining his performance, Honest John reported, "The whole affair came upon me so suddenly that no time was left for reflection." His request that he be relieved of command on account of ill health was quickly granted. "I truly feel ashamed for our side," one executive said when the smoke had cleared away. Porter, on blockade duty outside the Southwest Pass at the time, expressed a stronger opinion. It was, he said, the most ridiculous affair that ever took place in the American Navy. All the same, it helped in the formulation of his plan by showing what manner of resistance could be expected below New Orleans. In addition to the problem of getting across the bar and past the heavily gunned forts, He knew that the small Confederate flotilla would attempt to make up in daring and ingenuity for what it lacked in size. Besides, it might not be so small in time. There were reports of two monster ironclads, larger and faster than any the Federal Navy had ever dreamed of, already under construction in the city's shipyards. Then, too, there were land batteries at Chalmette, where Andrew Jackson's volunteers had stood behind a barricade of cotton bales and mowed down British regulars 50 years ago. The bars, the forts, the rebel boats, the batteries, these four, plus unknown others. But the greatest of these, as things now stood, was the problem of passing the forts. It was as a solution of this that Porter conceived and submitted his plan for the capture of New Orleans. The rest could be left to a flag officer who, having done his reflecting beforehand, would not panic in a crisis. The naval expedition, as Porter saw it, would have at its core a flotilla of 20 mortar vessels, each mounting a ponderous 13-inch mortar supplied with 1,000 shells. Screened by intervening trees, they would tie up to bank, just short of the bend, and blanket the forts with high-angle fire while the sea-going sloops and frigates made a run past in the darkness and confusion. The fleet was to mount no fewer than 200 heavy guns, exclusive of the mortars, which would assure it more firepower than the enemy had in his forts and boats combined, with the Chalmette batteries thrown in for good measure. Once past the forts, it could wreck the rebel vessels and batteries by the sheer weight of thrown metal. New Orleans, under the frown of federal warships, would have to choose between destruction and surrender. Army troops, brought along for the purpose, otherwise the show would be purely Navy, would go ashore to guard against internal revolt and outside attempts at recapture, thus freeing the fleet for other upriver objectives. Baton Rouge, Natchez, Vicksburg, and conjunction with Foote's ironclads steaming south. The Mississippi would be federal, from Minnesota all the way to the Gulf. By mid-November, Porter was in Washington submitting his proposal to the secretary. Wells had small use for the commander personally. He had too much Gasconade for the New Englanders' taste, and before the war he had associated overmuch with Southerners. But the plan itself, coinciding as it did with some thinking Wells had been doing along this line, won his immediate approval. He took him to see the president, who liked it too. "This should have been done sooner," Lincoln said, and arranged a conference with McClellan, whose cooperation would be needed. McClellan saw merit in the plan, but raised some characteristic objections. In his opinion, the expedition would entail a siege by 50,000 troops, for the heavy guns inside the forts would crush the wooden ships like eggshells. Bristling, Wells replied that the Navy would do the worrying about the risk to its ships. All he wanted from the Army was 10,000 men, to be added to the 5,000 which Benjamin Butler, flushed by the recent amphibious victory at Hatteras Inlet, was raising now in Massachusetts for service down on the Gulf. When McClellan replied that he could spare that many, Butler in particular could be spared along with his known talent for cabal, the conference at once got down to specifics. Secrecy, a prime element of the plan, would be extremely difficult to maintain because of the necessarily large-scale preparations. However, if the expedition's existence could hardly be hidden, perhaps its destination could. With this in mind, a new blockade squadron would be set up in the West Gulf, coincident with some loose talk about Pensacola, Mobile, Galveston, any place, in fact, except New Orleans. Next, a roster of ships was drawn up with an armament of about 250 guns. The choice of a fleet commander was left to Assistant Secretary G.V. Fox, himself a retired Annapolis man, who conferred with Porter on the matter, combing the list of captains. One after another, they were rejected, either for being otherwise employed or else for being too much of the Honest John type. At last they came to David Glasgow Farragut, 37th on the list. of Spanish extraction, 60 years old, and sitting now as a member of a retirement board at Brooklyn Navy Yard, Farragut was a veteran of more than 50 years active service, having begun as a 9-year-old acting midshipman aboard the Essex, whose captain, Porter's father, had informally adopted him and supervised his baptism of fire in the War of 1812. Here was a possibility. He was known to be stout-hearted and energetic. Every year on his birthday, he turned a handspring, explaining that he would know he was beginning to age when he found the exercise difficult. The trouble was, he was Southern-born, a native of Knoxville, and Southern-married, twice in fact, both times to ladies from Norfolk, which raised doubts as to his loyalty and accounted for his present inactive assignment. Porter, on his way to New York to arrange for the purchase and assembly of the mortar flotilla, was instructed to call on his foster brother and sound him out. The retirement board member was waiting for him, a smooth-shaven, square-built, hale-looking man with hazel eyes and heavy eyebrows, wearing his long side hair brushed across the top of his head to hide his baldness. Porter began by asking what he thought of his former associates now gone south. "Those damned fellows will catch it yet," Farragut replied. Asked if he would accept a command to go and fight those fellows, he said he would. Porter then badgered him by pretending that the objective would be Norfolk, his wife's birthplace. Farragut jumped up, crying, "I will take the command, only don't you trifle with me." Summoned to Washington, still without suspecting the purpose, he was questioned next by Fox, who asked, as if for a purely theoretical opinion, if he thought New Orleans could be taken from below. "Yes, emphatically," Farragut told him. "The forts are well down the river. Ships could easily run them, and New Orleans itself is undefended. It would depend somewhat on the fleet, however." "Well," Fox said, "with such a fleet as, say, 2 steam frigates, 5 screw sloops of the city's class, 12 gunboats, and some mortar vessels to shell the forts from high angle, why, I would engage to run those batteries with 2/3 of such a force. What would you say if appointed to head such an expedition?" "What would I say?" Farragut cried. He leaped to his feet and began to prowl about the room. Now he understood. The goal was to be New Orleans, which he knew well from years of living in it, and he was to have the flag. "What would I say?" he cried, and broke into exclamations of delight. So it was settled. He received his orders during the last week of the year, and began at once to fit out the 18 warships assigned to his fleet, including 2 steam frigates, 7 screw sloops, and 9 gunboats, all of wood and mounting 243 guns, most heavy. Porter, meanwhile, had been assembling his mortar flotilla of 20 schooners. The weapons themselves were cast in Pittsburgh, along with 30,000 bombshells, while the beds were manufactured in New York. In late January, Farragut dropped down to Hampton Roads, Porter coming along behind, and by mid-February reached Key West, where final orders from Wells were broken open. "This most important operation of the war is confined to yourself and your brave associates. If successful, you open the way to the sea for the Great West, never again to be closed. The rebellion will be riven in the center, and the flag to which you have been so faithful will recover its supremacy in every state." Convinced by inspection that the way to stop the small-time blockade runners working in and out of the coastal lakes and bayous was to intercept them with vessels adapted to the task, Farragut wrote to the Navy Department asking for some light ships of 5-foot draft or less. Since he neglected to say what use would be made of them, Fox thought they were wanted for the upriver attack, which would have meant an unconscionable delay. Dismayed, the assistant secretary began to suspect that he had erred in his choice of a fleet commander. Instead of writing to Farragut, however, he wrote to Porter. "I trust that we have made no mistake in our man, but his dispatches are very discouraging. It is not too late to rectify our mistake. You must frankly give me your views. I shall have no peace until I hear from you. Porter replied that it was too late for a change, but that he would do what he could to bolster the old man's shaky judgment. Men of his age in a seafaring life are not fit for important enterprises. They lack the vigor of youth. He talks very much at random at times and rather underrates the difficulties before him without fairly comprehending them. I know what they are, and as he is impressible, hope to make him appreciate them also. He added by way of consolation, I have great hopes of the mortars if all else fails. Happily unaware of the distrust of his superiors or the condescension of his adoptive brother, Farragut proceeded to Ship Island for refueling and refitting. By mid-March, he was off the mouths of the Mississippi, maneuvering for an entrance, which was finally effected by sending Porter's mortars and the gunboats through Pasalutra and taking the heavier frigates and sloops around to Southwest Pass. After much sweat and inch-by-inch careening, back-breaking labor that tried even Farragut's sunny disposition, all got over the bar except the largest, a 50-gun frigate, 20 of whose guns were distributed among the other vessels of the fleet now assembled at head of the passes. There the schooners discharged their sea-going spars and made ready for the work they had been built to do. By mid-April the preparations were complete. Butler's soldiers were at hand, 18,000 of them, so persuasively had the former politician done his recruiting job in New England. The fleet was at anchor 2 miles below the bend where the mortar schooners had tied up to both banks, the tips of their masts disguised with foliage, lest they show above the trees that screened the vessels from the forts. Ranges were quickly established, 2,850 yards to Fort Jackson, 3,680 to Fort St. Philip. Farragut was somewhat doubtful as to the efficacy of the snub-nosed weapons, but Porter declared confidently that 2 days of mortar bombardment would reduce both forts to rubble. April 18th, Good Friday, he opened fire. Holy Week was gloomy in New Orleans, the more so because of the contrast between the present frame of mind, with danger looming stark in both directions, and the elation felt 6 months ago at the comic repulse of the sloops from the head of the passes, which had seemed to give point to the popular conviction that nothing afloat could pass the forts, nothing that walked could get through our swamps. Since then, a great deal had happened, and all of it bad. For one thing, the blockade had tightened. Roustabouts no longer swarmed on the levee, for there were no cargoes to unload. The wharves lay idle, and warehouses, formerly bulging with cotton and sugar and grain, yawned hollow. Trade having come to a standstill, ready money was so scarce that there was a current joke that an olive oil label would pass for cash because it was greasy, smelt bad, and bore an autograph. For another, Foote's gunboats and Pope's soldiers were smashing obstacles so rapidly upriver that the danger seemed even greater from that direction, with neither forts nor swamps to slow them down. In the midst of these discouragements and fears, troops assigned to the city's defense were called north to fight at Shiloh, and all that returned from that repulse were the members of the Honor Guard with Sidney Johnston's body, following the muffled drums and the empty-saddled war horse out St. Charles Street to fire the prescribed 3 volleys across his crypt. Now there was this. Yankee ships once more across the bar, but in such strength that no small-scale attack, however ingenious and daring, could hope to budge them. For New Orleans, as for the South at large, the prospect was grim in this season of death and resurrection. No one responsible for the city's defense was more aware of the danger than the man who was most responsible of all, Mansfield Lovell, a 39-year-old Maryland-born West Pointer who had resigned as New York Deputy Street Commissioner to join the Confederacy in September. Impressed with the Chapultepec-breveted artilleryman's record as an administrator, Davis made him a major general and sent him to replace the overaged Twiggs in New Orleans, which would not only give the city an energetic and efficient commander, but would also call widespread attention to the fact that willingness to fight for the South's ideals was by no means restricted to men of Southern background. Lovell having spent most of his civilian years as a New Jersey ironworks executive. The new Major General arrived in early October and was appalled at the unpreparedness. There was plenty of Gallic enthusiasm, but it found release at champagne parties rather than at work. He wrote to Richmond protesting that the city was greatly drained of arms, ammunition, clothing, and supplies for other points. Presently it was drained of fighting men as well, leaving him with what he called a heterogeneous militia of 3,000 short-term volunteers, armed mostly with shotguns against 9 and 11-inch Dahlgrens. The Creoles did not resent his criticisms. They found his intensity amusing and his presence ornamental. A very attractive figure, one pronounced him, giving the eye, at first glance, a promise of much activity. His horsemanship was especially admirable. They enjoyed watching him ride dragoon style, with so long a stirrup leather that he simply stood astride the saddle, as straight as a spear. To add to the effect, he wore a facial ruff of hair much like Burnside's, except that it was light brown and somewhat less flamboyant. Despite his activity, no one was more surprised when the Union fleet showed its true intention. Not that he had not known it was assembling. Agents had kept him informed of its strength and location. But they had also relayed the loose talk about Mobile and Pensacola, and Lovell believed them, perhaps because he wanted to. What misled him most, though, was the presence of Ben Butler, who at the Democratic Convention of 1860 had voted 57 consecutive times for the nomination of Jefferson Davis before switching over to Breckinridge with the majority. I regard Butler's Ship Island expedition as a harmless menace so far as New Orleans is concerned, Lovell had told Richmond in late February. A black Republican dynasty will never give an old Breckinridge Democrat like Butler command of any expedition which they had any idea would result in such a glorious success as the capture of New Orleans. Now he knew better. The warships were across the bar above the head of the passes, but the knowledge came too late. He had been looking upriver all this time, where the Foot Grant, Foot Pope amphibious teams were wrecking whatever stood in their way, ashore or afloat. Hastening to meet the threat from above, his intelligence reports were quite good from that direction, too good as it turned out, he had commandeered 14 paddle-wheel steamers and converted them into one-gun gunboats, plating their outer bulwarks with inch-thick railroad iron to give them mass and rigidity for use as rams. Launched one by one between January and April, they made up the River Defense Fleet under J.E. Montgomery, a river captain, and were independent of Commander J.K. Mitchell, whose miniature flotilla had thrown such a scare into honest John Pope 6 months before. Lovell did not like the command arrangement, which left him no real control over either. Besides, the new gunboats were put in the hands of a notoriously independent breed of men. 14 Mississippi River captains and pilots will never agree about anything once they get underway, he predicted. As fast as they came off the ways, 8 of the boats were sent upriver to challenge the descending Union fleet at Memphis or Fort Pillow, though Lovell managed to hold on to 6 of them for the immediate protection of New Orleans. They would not amount to much in the way of a deterrent once the heavy-gunned armada below the forts broke into the clear, but anything that would delay or distract the Federal fleet, however briefly, even to the extent of making it pause to brush them aside, might be of enormous value because of something else that was going on inside the city. He had an ace in the hole, 2, in fact. The question was whether he would have time to bring them out and play them. Porter had heard aright in his talks with the pilots and oystermen. The Confederates were at work on 2 giant ironclads in the city's shipyards, each of them more formidable than the Merrimack, Virginia, which had just completed her work of destruction in Hampton Roads against vessels as stout as any in Farragut's fleet. The first, the Louisiana, mounting 16 heavy rifles, had been launched and cased in a double row of T-shaped rails for armor, the inner rails bolted vertically to the bulwarks, the outer ones reversed and driven down the gaps. There had been various delays, including strikes. One lasted 3 full weeks, because the workers were unwilling to take Confederate bonds for pay, but the main trouble now was her power plant, which had been transferred from a steamboat. While Farragut was crossing the bar, mechanics were trying without success to coax the Louisiana's engines into motion. The other ironclad, the Mississippi, was an even more novel and formidable proposition, at least in prospect. Over 4,000 tons in weight, 270 feet long and 58 feet in the beam, drawing only 14 feet and mounting 20 guns, she was a true dreadnought, designed to wear 3-inch armor, have an iron snout set over a casing 3 feet thick, and be propelled by 3 engines at a speed of 14 knots, all of which would make her the most powerful and fastest warship ever built. The plan for her use was quite in scale with her proportions. She was to clear the Mississippi of enemy vessels, then the Gulf and the Atlantic, after which she would lay the northern coastal cities under levy. Improbable as this program sounded, it was by no means impossible. Certainly nothing afloat or under construction could stand in her way. But first she would have to be finished, and she was still a considerable way from that. She had been launched, her timber work completed, but so far she was armored only below the gun deck, and her vital 50-foot central drive shaft was too big a casting job for any southern rolling mill except the Tredegar in Richmond, which began work on the order in February. It would be weeks or months before delivery and installation of the shaft would permit her to move under her own power. Time, then, was golden. Lovell bought what he could and tried to buy more by calling for the 8 departed gunboats to be returned from upriver. This the government would not do, considering them more needed there to stem the rout at Island 10 and make a shield for Memphis. New Orleans would have to resist with what she had. Primarily, then, with the federal fleet already approaching the bend they guarded, that put the burden on Forts Jackson and St. Philip, whose strength or vulnerability had become a subject of disagreement among the rivermen who had been so confident such a short time back. A chain boom held afloat by cypress logs spanned the Mississippi just below the forts, so that when the Yankees ran afoul of it or stopped to try and break it, plunging fire from the parapets would blow them out of the water like sitting ducks. So the rivermen had reckoned, but the March floods, the highest in anyone's memory, brought such a press of uprooted trees and brush against it that the boom gave way, depriving the gunners of their hope for stationary targets. Quickly the break was mended and the obstacle strengthened by adding a line of hulks to buoy it up. Now that it had broken once, however, there was considerable doubt that it would hold against the pressure which was building up again. In desperation, Lovell ordered the Louisiana towed downstream to be tied up to the east bank just above Fort St. Philip. No less than 50 mechanics continued to tinker with her engines, but even if they never got them going, she could serve as a floating battery, adding the weight of her bow and starboard guns to those of the forts. Work continued aboard the Mississippi, too, on the outside chance that her drive shaft would arrive before the Federals did. It was Holy Week, Ash Wednesday, then Good Friday, and a message arrived from downriver. Both forts were under heavy bombardment, receiving 2 200-pound mortar shells a minute. Lovell rode down to see for himself how bad it was. It was bad enough, or anyhow it seemed so. At the end of the first day's firing, the citadel and barracks of Fort Jackson were ablaze, rubble and sandbags thrown about and the protective levee cut, letting backwater into the place. "I was obliged to confine the men most rigidly to the casemates," the commandant reported. or else we should have lost the best part of the garrison." They huddled there, white-faced with alarm, while the world outside seemed turned to flame and thunder. And yet it was by no means as bad as it seemed, being a good deal more spectacular than effective. Casualties were extremely low in both forts, and nothing really vital was hit in either. In fact, when Porter slowed the rate of fire at nightfall to give his weary crews some rest, his own men were rather more shaken up than those at the opposite ends of the looping trajectories. Soon after noon, the lead East Bank schooner had taken a solid through her deck and bottom and had to be shifted down the line. What was more, the work itself was heavy, each piece being required to deliver a round every 10 minutes, and the strain of absorbing the ear-pounding, bone-jarring concussions was severe. It was as if the bombardiers had spent those hours inside a tolling bell. Porter had them back at their rapid-fire work by dawn. He had said he would silence the forts by sunset of the second day, and he intended to do it. All day the firing continued, but with less apparent effect than yesterday, the bursting shells having done all the superficial damage there was to do. At dusk, the rebel casemate guns were still in action. Porter did not slacken fire. All night it continued, all Easter day, all Easter night, all Monday. Still the guns replied. In 96 hours, twice Porter's original estimate as to the time it would take to reduce them, the forts had absorbed over 13,000 shells, at a cost of only 4 men killed, 14 wounded, and 7 guns disabled. Porter's crews were near exhaustion, but he would not slacken fire. All Monday night, all Tuesday, Tuesday night, and Wednesday morning it continued. 16,800 shells had been pumped into the forts, which still replied. Then Farragut intervened. He had never placed much reliance on the mortars anyhow. "Look here, David," he said, "we'll demonstrate the practical value of mortar work." He turned to his clerk. "Mr. Osborne, get 2 small flags, a white one and a red one, and go to the mizzen topmast head and watch the shells fall. If inside the fort, wave the red flag. If outside, wave the white one." In the beginning, the fire had been accurate, but the gunners had been numbed into indifference by now. The white flag waved from the masthead far more often than the red. Farragut said calmly, "There's the score. I guess we'll go up the river tonight." Porter protested, heart and soul. Even if the fleet got past the forts, it would leave them alive in its rear. How would the infantry manage the run in unarmed and unarmored transports? Besides, with the Federal warships gone upriver, what would prevent the surviving enemy gunboats from attacking the mortar flotilla? Farragut replied casually that Butler's men could make a roundabout trip, coming in through the Gulf bayous. As for the threat of rebel survivors, he didn't intend for there to be any, but if there were, then Porter would just have to look out for himself. He called his gig and made the rounds of all his ships, confirming the orders already issued for the run to be made that night. He would abide by the result, he told them, conquer or be conquered. His 2 biggest worries, how to get across or through the boom and how to deal with fire rafts, had already been lessened or disposed of. Sunday night, 2 gunboats had gone forward under heavy fire and opened a gap by releasing the chain from one of the hulks. When the defenders responded by sending a fire raft through the breach, flames leaping 100 feet in the air, considerable frenzy had ensued, including a collision between 2 ships whose captains panicked at the threat of being roasted. However, by the time the current had carried the burning mass of pitch and pine harmlessly into the east bank, they knew better how to deal with or avoid them. Farragut had been for running the forts the following night, but a strong north wind had risen to slow him down. It blew through Tuesday, then Wednesday it died, and he was ready, having spent the interim preparing his wooden ships for the ordeal. Chains were looped down over the sides to protect the engines and magazines. Jacob's ladders were hung all round, so the carpenters could descend quickly and patch from the outside any holes shot in the hulls. Tubs of water were spotted about, and each ship had a well-drilled fire brigade equipped with grapnels for handling fire rafts. The outer bulwarks were smeared with mud to hide the ships from the spotters in the forts, but the decks and the breeches of the guns were given a coat of whitewash to provide reflected light for night work. As a final touch, one that never failed to provoke a sensation at the pit of every sailor's stomach, no matter how often he had seen it done before, the area around each gun was strewn with sand and ashes, so that when the fight grew hot, the gun crews would not slip in their own blood. That was all. Now there was only the waiting, which a gunner aboard the flagship thought the hardest job of all. "One has nothing to do to occupy the mind," he complained. "The mind runs on the great uncertainty about to take place until it is a relief when the battle opens." At 2 a.m., it was Thursday now, the 24th, the hour being, as Farragut said, propitious. He had just received a signal that the gateway through the boom was still ajar. Two red lanterns appeared at the Hartford's mizzen peak, and the lead division began to move upstream. His original plan had been to lead the attack himself aboard the flagship, but the senior captains, agreeing that the losses would be heavy, persuaded him that to risk losing the fleet commander at the outset would be to court disaster through confusion. So Farragut had arranged his 17 warships in three divisions of 8, 3, and 6 vessels, himself at the head of the second. It was a powerful aggregation, heavily gunned and backed by the fire of the mortars. If the weight of thrown metal was to decide the issue, there could be but one result, for an entire round of projectiles from all the federal guns would weigh more than 10 tons, while one from all the Confederate guns, afloat and ashore, would weigh just 3.5. Farragut and his captains were not aware of these figures, however, or at any rate not the latter. All they knew was what they had been taught, that one gun ashore was worth 4 afloat. They knew, too, that the forts were built of brick and mortar, while the ships were built of wood. Farragut was confident, even cheerful, but when his clerk declared that he did not expect the fleet to lose beyond 100 men, the Tennessee-born captain shook his head in doubt. "I wish I could think so," he said. There were delays as the various sloops and gunboats jockeyed for position, each division moving in line ahead, breasting the broad dark current. Then at 3:40 the rebel lookouts spotted the lead division just as it reached the boom and started through the gap. Now delay was on the other side. The first 8 ships were clear of the chain before the forts reacted. But when they did, according to an army man who had come up to watch the show, the effect was tremendous. Imagine all the earthquakes in the world and all the thunder and lightnings together in a space of 2 miles, all going off at once. That would be like it. Flaming brush piles along the banks and fire rafts on the river cast an eerie refulgence, pocked with rolling clouds of gun smoke and the sudden scarlet of exploding shells. At this point, the Hartford, leading the 2nd Division through the gap, made her entrance as if upon a brightly lighted stage. It seemed to Farragut, high in the mizzen rigging, his feet on the ratlines and his back against the shrouds, as if the artillery of heaven were playing on earth. But one of his gunners drew a comparison from the opposite direction. "My youthful imagination of hell did not equal the scene about us at this moment." Presently, however, there could be little doubt as to which description was more fitting. Attempting to dodge a fire raft, the flagship's helmsman ran her into shallow water, directly under the guns of Fort St. Philip. Farragut, who had descended to the quarterdeck just before a shell burst cut away most of the rigging where he had been standing, saw a mud flat dead ahead. "Hard a port!" he shouted. Too late. She ran aground. Fortunately, the casemate gunners, expecting a landing party when they saw the Hartford's bowsprit looming over their heads, deserted their pieces. But the fire raft, pushed by a tug, changed course and rammed the flank of the grounded sloop, flames curling over the bulwarks and shooting up the rigging. When Farragut saw his ship afire, his men giving back from the press of heat as the tug held the mass of burning pine firmly against her quarter, He threw up his hands and clasped them over his head in an anguished gesture. "My God, is it to end this way?" he cried. But he soon recovered his composure. Down on the gun deck, his clerk had conceived the notion of rolling some 20-pound shells onto the flaming raft, where they would explode and sink it. As he knelt to unscrew the fuse caps, Farragut saw him and mistook his attitude. "Come, sir, this is no time for prayer," he told him sternly, and called down also to the gunners, still holding back from the licking tongues of flame. "Don't flinch from that fire, boys. There's a hotter fire than that waiting for those who don't do their duty. Give that rascally little tug a shot." Then suddenly the worst was over. Catching the old man's spirit, despite the heat, the port crews returned to their guns and gave the tug two shots that hulled and sank her. The clerk got three of the shells uncapped and dropped them onto the blazing raft, which was torn apart by the explosion and went down in a hissing cloud of steam. While the fire brigade got busy with hoses and buckets extinguishing the flames, the helmsman called for full power astern, and the ship careened off the mudflat, free to continue her course upriver and join in the destruction of the rebel flotilla. Very little of it was left by now, when the skippers of the dozen Confederate vessels saw the northern warships clear the boom, run the gauntlet of fire from the forts, and head directly for them, apparently unscathed, big guns booming. They reacted with dismay, as well they might, all 12 of them together with the immobilized Louisiana thrown in for